Arthur C. Jones is a professor in the Department of Musicology, Ethnomusicology, and Theory at the Lamont School of Music at the University of Denver. He's the founder of the Spirituals Project. It's a nonprofit organization working to preserve and revitalize the music and social justice teachings of African American spirituals. In January of 2017, we caught up with Jones to talk about the importance of preserving this specific piece of music history. We began with the origin of his research.
Well, it started back in the early 1990s. I was actually teaching psychology here at the University of Denver. I was in the psychology department, and I'm trained as a clinical psychologist, and I had started immersing myself in music. Music was something that had been really dear to my heart when I was in high school and college, but I had sort of given it up to pursue my career as a psychologist. But when I started singing again, I found my way back to these old songs that, you know, we had sung in church when I was a child and so forth. And initially, it was just really the enjoyment of singing these songs that I was familiar with. But then, as I started really to think about what the songs were, I realized that I should be spending more time with understanding the history of the songs and kind of how they have evolved over time and what functions they've served. And before I knew it, I was really hooked.
Was there a great deal of research already existing that you sort of stumbled upon, or did you have to create some of your own research? I know you've written a book.
That's a really great question. There was a lot of stuff that was out there, but it was very scattered, and it wasn't particularly integrated. People had all these questions about, you know, we've heard that the songs were used for secret communication on the Underground Railroad, and we've heard that the freedom songs in the civil rights movement were based on spirituals, you know, things like that. And you could find all this stuff if you really looked for it. And part of what I wanted to do in the book that I wrote was to synthesize all that information into one place. And I also set an impossible task for myself, which I think I sort of at least partially accomplished, which was I wanted it to be a book that would be readable for lay readers, but I also wanted scholars to be able to find something of interest in it as well. Mm-hmm. So what I did was I created a narrative that was accessible to anyone who's interested, and then I put all the scholarly asides in the footnotes, so if scholars wanted to do that.
And the book is called Wade in the Water, The Wisdom of Spirituals. So take me back to sort of the early origins. How far back does the spiritual go?
Well, it definitely goes back into slavery. How far back is really not known, and the reason is because American scholars, white American scholars, didn't really start studying these songs seriously until the Civil War period, when some of the Union soldiers heard the blacks who were volunteering to serve in the army, they heard them singing these songs, and then they decided that they wanted to record them or notate them and make a record of them. You know, before that, these were songs that were sung in the slave community, and it was for use by people who were enslaved, and nobody outside that community thought that this was serious music or anything that needed to be recorded, and the slave culture was an oral culture, so it's really hard to know. We do know that at least by the early 1900, these songs were pretty prevalent, but before that, we're not sure. My own opinion is that it probably goes back to the 17th century, at least.
How different are those early spirituals from the other music of their time?
Well, they're very different. What we had really was people who were bringing their African cultural sensibilities to their singing. And so the music resembles a lot of what you would have heard in West Africa. Over time, there were more and more European elements that got integrated into the music, especially when the slave trade became primarily became primarily an instance of slave holders wanting to breed their slaves as opposed to importing additional people from West Africa. And so the more people were sort of intergenerational beings of these slave plantations, the more and more European elements got introduced. And then after slavery, there was a concert tradition that got started that became more and more Europeanized, so to speak, but still had a lot of the rhythmic and sort of soulful elements of the original music.
So what does a spiritual do for the people who are singing it during the time of slavery? What does it do for enslaved humans?
Yeah, boy, you asked really wonderful questions, and this is a great one, too. There were multiple functions, and probably the most important function was the function of dealing with trauma and overcoming the psychological trauma that people experienced, that they could voice their feelings in their singing, and in the process of voicing those feelings, they could start a cycle of healing. So that was like really one of the most important functions. Another one was simply creating community solidarity. So the enslaved people would gather together in secret at the end of the day in the bush groves that surrounded these plantations, and they would sing their songs and create new songs there, and those songs would bond them together as a community so that they could sort of feel like they had some mutual support in getting through all the stuff they had to do. And then another function was protest and resistance. The songs often had encoded messages that let people know that it was time for the Underground Railroad to be accessed by people who were wanting to escape, or it would announce the time that there was going to be an insurrection or rebellion. So he had all these different functions that the songs served.
Can you give me an example of a song that maybe I might know from hearing choirs sing that might have had a message that communicated more than what's on its surface?
So Swing Low, Sweet Chariot, do you know that song?
I sure do.
Okay. So that's probably the most well-known spiritual of all the spirituals, and the lyrics are, swing low, sweet chariot, coming for to carry me home, right? And the chariot in all of these slave songs, later on you also had, sometimes you'd hear a song, songs that had train in them.
Right.
They all really were basically, it sort of had double meaning. One was that slaves often felt so bereft and so beat up that they were just waiting to die. And so the chariot is just kind of a symbol of a heavenly vehicle that will take them to heaven. But the other meaning was that it was a symbol of the Underground Railroad. So when people would sing this song, it would be a signal that the time to escape was coming, that people should be vigilant and listen out for information about how they might escape on the Underground Railroad.
Do the slaveholders then have a sense that this music has relevance beyond what they're initially seeing? Do they get it? Do they try to oppress the music as well?
Yes and no. You know, that's a really interesting kind of dynamic that comes out of this, is that they knew, I mean, what they knew often was that when they heard a lot of singing, there sometimes came a time when, very shortly after that, people would have escaped or there would be a rebellion or whatever. So they knew that, in general terms, singing was rebellious. But the interesting thing is that there's no record of them ever figuring out the secret message of specific lyrics. And one of the things that some scholars have said about that is that partly is that they so underestimated the intelligence of the people that they were holding in slavery. They didn't really think of them as creative, intelligent people, so it never crossed their mind that they could make up something as complicated as an encoded message in a song. So Harriet Tubman, you know, who is known as one of the most important leaders of the Underground Railroad, tells the story in her memoir of when she was leaving her plantation, actually walking away, escaping from the plantation, and walking past the master's house, singing a song, you know, goodbye, I'm going to leave you, you know, and the master is like, oh, there goes old Harriet again, talking about going to heaven, had no clue, did not get alarmed. So she was simply able to just walk away.
And that is why Harriet Tubman is Harriet Tubman.
Exactly.
that takes a courage. Oh.
And a
wisdom and an intellect and an understanding that is beyond. Let's jump ahead to the civil rights movement in America in 1960s. Yeah. These songs are expanded upon by civil rights leaders, folk musicians. Tell me about that era.
Well, one of the things that happened in the civil rights movement is that a lot of the folks who were organizers of the movement recognized that singing was really important, that singing in African-American communities had always been an essential part of what people did. And especially since the movement, a lot of the organizing and the meetings were held in churches, and African-American churches, especially in the rural areas, had this long tradition of communal singing. And they knew that when people were feeling threatened and frightened about what might happen as a result of their participation, that they needed to be able to sing. And the easiest thing they could do was to pull out some of these old songs that had been in the air for ages and repurpose them as freedom songs. And sometimes they would change the lyrics, and sometimes they would just take the original song. So like one of the more popular freedom songs of the movement was "Woke Up This Morning With My Mind Stayed on Freedom." Mm-hmm. Well, the original spiritual was "Woke Up This Morning With My Mind Stayed on Jesus." So they just changed changed the Jesus to freedom and became a freedom song. So, you know, that's a good example. Another song that actually didn't get changed in terms of lyrics was "Oh Freedom." You know, "Oh Freedom over me, before I be a slave, I'll be buried in my grave and go home to my Lord and be free." They just took that song and they said, you know, segregation is much like slavery. We don't need to change those words. We'll just use the song whole. You know, "We Shall Overcome" is basically an appropriation of an old spiritual, which was "I Will Overcome Someday," that had been sung. And then some of the movement leaders just changed it to "We." That one was an interesting one because in traditional African-American songs, you never see the word "we." You see "I."
Really?
"I shall overcome this little light of mine."
Mm-hmm.
And because it was sort of tacitly understood in the black community that if everybody sings "I," everybody's making a commitment to the group. And you don't sing. If you sing "we," you never know who's there and who isn't. Everybody's singing "we," but it doesn't mean, well, is John going to be there? Is Eliza going to be there?
Hmm.
But if you sing "I," everybody sings "I," so that means everybody is committed and they are automatically a group. But when the civil rights movement became an interracial movement and there were people from outside the black community who were involved, the song leaders thought that they better use "we" so people would know that it means the group.
It's
like, which is really interesting.
That is interesting.
Yeah.
So we have just a couple minutes left. I could really talk to you for an hour, but I'm wondering if very quickly we could talk about the choir and specifically just how singing these songs today can sort of change, you know, the person who's doing the singing as well as the audience.
Yeah. Well, one of the remarkable things about the choir that has been part of the Spirituals Project is that we have lots of people who join the choir, not just because they want to be in a choir, but because they're going through difficult things in their life, or they really are in need of a strong community. And one of the tensions that we've had in the choir, which is kind of interesting, is that we have people who want to be in the choir who really can't sing, but they want to be part of they want to be part of the choir. So our choir directors over the years have kind of looked the other way in auditions when they have someone who they know really needs to be in this community, but they can't sing, and they figure out ways to put them in and allow them to be part of the community and sort of subtly encourage them to just lip sync when it's important for them to do that.
That's Arthur C. Jones, founder of The Spirituals Project.